Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick, and we are broadcasting from my apartment. Like everybody else, we're making adjustments. Since its outbreak last year, the coronavirus, COVID-19, has thrown the world into disarray. Travel from Europe has been restricted for 30 days at least. Financial markets have tanked. Saudi Arabia canceled the Hajj, the Islamic pilgrimage. The NBA has suspended the basketball season. And who knows what could happen to all kinds of public assemblages, theaters, the Olympics, and all the rest. And in China, where the outbreak began, nearly 800 million people have been living under some kind of restriction.
Hello? Oh, yeah, I can hear you fine.
Given all this, we rang up our staff writer, Peter Hessler, on Skype. Peter has reported for years from China. He went back with his family last year to teach at Sichuan University.
Yeah, no, we're in Chengdu, which is in the southwest. It's the capital of Sichuan province. And so, yes, I mean, we've been quarantined since, January, late January. We have 2 9-year-olds. We have twin daughters. They're in Chinese public school. And so the city, so my kids are not in school. And, this has been more than a month. My kids have not seen another kid their age for more than a month.
Now, here in the States, we talk about self-quarantining. That's a voluntary decision to keep others safe. But in China, a quarantine is a quarantine.
Usually in many compounds, they would allow like one person out from each household every 2 days. Because we're sort of in a higher end thing, there was no limit. We have to have a card to go in and out, but we can go in and out as much as we want. And so I went out a lot because I would bike around and see what's going on in the city. And, there's more people out. There was a long stretch when there was absolutely nobody on the street. And there wasn't much open, but convenience stores were always open. Kind of like small markets were always open. People, at least around here, didn't have problems with food because a lot of people do stuff online anyway here. And so I've kind of tracked what my neighbors are like, the weird shit people buy during this time. Like there's some guy upstairs about like 100-inch television, and you see them, these guys in masks trying to bring, that's probably what my, but there's a lot of stuff like that. And then also just the whole mask fetish, that people, which also serves absolutely no point at all. And if you don't have it, people get angry. People yell at me because I run along the river in the mornings and people would scream at me. They're kind of mellowing out a little more now, but like a week or 10 days ago, they would go totally ballistic,
New cases of COVID-19 have fallen in China in recent days. President Xi Jinping visited Wuhan, the epicenter, as a show of confidence that the Communist Party has the virus under control. Peter says you can see right on the ground the power of Xi Jinping's government.
There's a big sign in front of our building that actually has all the local government officials and their phone numbers and their pictures, which is a very unusual thing to have in China. Of course, I called and then they, within minutes, set up an appointment and I met the local party secretary. And so this is sort of unusually open in that sense. This is a little section of like a neighborhood of the city that has 6,000 residents. They've had one case, which is the guy in my building. But it's also just kind of an amazing, the violations of privacy, because in many places, like my students write about, like they will publish people's names who have it. I've seen a few things I think very misguided where they talk about this as a threat to the party. I don't feel like that at all. I mean, I think this really reinforces their strength. I think it actually makes more people have faith in them.
And while the World Health Organization has praised China's efforts, these are measures that only a truly authoritarian regime can pull off, which has Peter a little concerned.
I have like serious, reservations about this kind of situation. Like, I think it's really bad that to have to shut things down in this way. When you're building a society, it's not just about numbers on a death rate. To me, like, mental health is a big issue. And to me, like, being free from fear is a big part of that. I get in the elevator, and people won't get in the elevator with me, first of all. And if they do, they turn their back to me often. And I think this is a psychological issue. I think it damages community. But all these things, it's not a body count, and that's what you're up against on the other side, because they'll just say, well, look at how the numbers went down in the quarantine. And those are people who are still alive, And the thing is, there is everybody, the public health people will tell you what's better to have an overreaction, underreaction. But I think there may be a point where that's not true. I think there is a more subtle way to do this, a longer term approach. You know, your quarantine and what they would call social distancing has to be more targeted to the groups that matter. You have to recognize that the disease sort of runs its course, and that there's probably not going to be a silver bullet for it. And also, like, eventually it comes back. Until you either have a vaccine or until you get herd immunity, this thing still is around. Like, because people have this idea that it's being defeated. You know, it's not like you do this and then it's done. It's going to come back.
Peter Hessler is a staff writer living under quarantine with his family right now in Chengdu. You can read Peter's reporting from China and more at newyorker.com. His recent book, which is about Egypt, is called The Buried. More in a moment.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit newyorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. For most of us, the speed and intensity of the coronavirus pandemic came on as a shock. But maybe not for Lawrence Wright. Larry is a terrific journalist, the author of major books about Al-Qaeda and the Church of Scientology, among others. And he's been a staff writer since 1992. Larry has been imagining a virus like COVID-19, teasing out its consequences for a book that he's called The End of October. Now, this book is not journalism. The End of October is fiction, very much a thriller, but the circumstances certainly ring familiar. Larry, you're talking to me from a studio in Austin, Texas, where you've lived for a long time, and Austin is the home of South by Southwest, this huge music and film and technology festival, and was one of the first big events to be canceled. Tell me about the mood in Austin where coronavirus is concerned, and what does the cancellation mean for Austin?
Well, it's a $350 million loss to the economy, but that's just, you know, what would have been the spending. Everybody is very worried about the effect on the service industries, the restaurants, the hotels. There's so many, you know, gig workers who are just going to be flattened by this because so much of their yearly income depends on this couple of weeks of South By. My daughter used to rent out her house for South By and maybe Formula One, and it would pay her rent for the entire year.
Wow.
Well, that's not going to happen. And what's shocking to me, we haven't had a single case yet in Travis County that has been discovered, at least. But there's hardly any cars on the streets. I'm at the university. I only see a handful of students walking around. It's really quite striking, even in Austin.
So we imagine the impact of an outbreak like COVID-19. We think a lot about the immediate health effects, the people infected, the people who will recover, the number who don't. But your novel, and I should emphasize, it's a novel, not a book of science journalism, but we'll get to the research in a second. Your novel deals a lot with the unexpected ways that an outbreak can influence not just the public health, but culture and politics and economies. And are those second-order effects of a virus more dangerous than the virus itself? How would you equate that?
Well, they're certainly more enduring. You know, viruses come and sweep through a population. They may return, they may not. But, like cholera, cities have been built, designed because of cholera, to have sanitation, clean water, clean air. All of that is because of cholera. Cholera is easily dealt with in the modern era, but the enduring effects of those cholera plagues is still with us.
The novel's about a virus of your own imagining. It's not about COVID-19. Tell me about the virus in your book.
Well, I call it the Congolese flu. I chose influenza as my medium because it is still the most dangerous virus that we're faced with. And I pictured it starting in Indonesia in a refugee camp. Indonesia has been persecuting homosexuals, and so I imagined that there was a camp, a detention center, where a number of people have HIV/AIDS, and their immune systems are compromised. And in that environment, a novel infection, a flu that has never been seen before, suddenly arises and takes root in the human population and becomes transmissible. And there is an attempt to quarantine the camp. But in the novel, the hero of the book goes to visit. His driver is contaminated and infected and goes to go on pilgrimage to Saudi Arabia for the Hajj. And that's how the virus really gets ignited.
What's really uncanny, and again, emphasizing that it's a novel, is that the global political conditions are so much like what we have now. You've got United States and Russia are in conflict. Saudi Arabia and Iran are at each other's throats. The threat of climate change is everywhere. And there's a not terribly responsive president in the White House, though he doesn't go named.
Yeah.
What happens to that world when this virus is unleashed in it? And does it bear any resemblance to what you're seeing every day now in the news?
Oh, David, it's so demoralizing. Honestly, I read the paper and I feel like I'm reading another chapter of my own book. And I, unfortunately, real life seems to have taken the form of art and outraced even some of my imagination.
Well, how do you mean? What are you observing now in the reaction to this coronavirus that resembles what you might have anticipated, and how is it outstripping it?
Well, specifically quarantine. You know, quarantine is not a cure by any means. Its only goal really is to forestall the advance of a disease so that time can be used to develop some kind of vaccine or cure. And I imagined 3 million people in Mecca on Hajj and quarantining that. It seemed to me, a real leap of imagination. It doesn't begin to compare with what China did. You know, 70 million people in Hubei province, you know, maybe 250 million people, 750 million people I read quarantined in one way or another. And now Italy, my own imagination would have balked at such a stupendous effort. I don't know what the world's going to be like when it's finally published in mid-April, and because this disease gallops along so much.
This isn't the first novel about an apocalyptic pandemic. Some in the past have had a pretty familiar form. There's a stable world, the virus throws that world into chaos, and then some brave souls defeat the virus and things go back to normal. That's not what happens in your book.
No.
Do those other novels get pandemics wrong somehow?
Well, you know, there are enduring consequences of any great pandemic, and they change the future course of human life. You know, smallpox, plague, you know, those great pandemics of the past are tremendous scars on history. They affected the outcome of wars. They affected the mortality of humanity for years to come. We tend to think after the 20th century, where there were so many triumphs of medicine, and we thought we had put the great plagues of the past to rest, excepting perhaps influenza. But then along came SARS, along came MERS, these other viruses that posed tremendous threats. Fortunately, we have been able to contain them somewhat, but they are incredibly dangerous.
Now, as you watch what's happening now, and obviously we're in early stages, how do you evaluate the American reaction to the pandemic on a government level?
Oh, God. Let's go back to, you know, when President Trump first came into office and fired the global pandemic team, including Admiral Timothy Weiner, who had handled the malaria outbreak in Africa and is credited with saving 6 million lives, and then cutting the budget for the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention so that they were no longer able to monitor the health in most countries in the world. We were handicapped going out of the gate. You know, America is not a country like China that will easily lock up cities and partition states. So, you know, that's, you know, the trust is going to be that people will take care of themselves. But that's not really going to happen. I think that people will isolate themselves. There is social distancing. I think a lot of Americans are taking this very responsibly. But still, there's not going to be an absolute wall up the way that there is in China.
In a sense, what you're suggesting is that there is an innate advantage to an authoritarian state like China's over a democratic, fluid state like the United States in this kind of situation.
Here's what I think about China in that, you know, it's an authoritarian country. It does not like to have any criticism. It hides any kinds of interior problems it might have. As we saw at the beginning of this outbreak, where that young doctor made an outcry and he was suppressed, and of course he eventually died of COVID-19. Previously, you know, SARS had broken out in China, and China hid that. When World Health Organization authorities went to China to examine the situation, there were reports that the authorities had placed SARS patients in taxis and had them ride around until the WHO officials were gone. That is the downside of an authoritarian government. The other side of it is a government that is as authoritarian and brutal as the Chinese government can enforce a quarantine that I don't think any other country in the world would be able to attempt.
What was your first thought when you heard about this outbreak in China late last year? Did you immediately think we could end up where we are today? Did you expect a different outcome somehow?
David, good evidence is I didn't unload my stocks. I didn't take any of the precautions that a person, given all the knowledge that I had, should have done. Like so many people, I kept thinking, this isn't going to affect me. It won't reach my home. But I've been unnerved by it. I think it's going to be a real challenge to our democracy. And it's going to inflict a whole lot of grief on the world in one way or another.
When you say there's a threat to our democracy with COVID-19, what do you mean?
You know, let's start with just the difficulty of having politics in a place where people can't assemble. You know, what's going to happen with the conventions? How about voting? How are we going to manage those kinds of things? This is not a good time to be going out to mass rallies.
Larry, what concerns do you have for publishing a novel into the teeth of this? Are you
worried?
Yes, well, you're worried.
I don't know how people are going to react to it.
You're worried because what? Or do you think it can provide information that's useful in a way that's maybe more easily or transmitted than, you know, a CDC announcement on television?
I think it'll make it understandable to people in a way that they couldn't maybe in another way. You know, there should be at least some hope from this novel in that there are these really ingenious, courageous people that are involved in fighting it. I went to the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda and talked to, you know, immunologists at Pfizer, and I went to Fort Detrick where a lot of the biowarfare research had been done. And I was so struck by the ingenuity and the courage of people who work in public health. And that's why the book is dedicated to them. People actually go into those situations and confront these very cunning ways that nature has of sickening and killing us. That really impresses me. And I have a lot of confidence in them.
Larry Wright, thank you so much.
It's my pleasure, David.
And
thank
best
you.
Of health to your family and everyone you know.
And same to you and yours.
Lawrence Wright has been a staff writer since 1992. His book, The End of October, just to be clear, is a work of fiction. It's due to be published this spring. I'm David Remnick, and that's our show for today. You can find much more of the New Yorker Radio Hour by subscribing to our podcast. Thanks for joining us. Be well, and see you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Gofen Mputubwele, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Allison McAdam, Morgan Flannery, Mengfei Chen, and Emily Mann. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.